Well, on Sunday nights, we've been looking through the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 25. We'll start there, but we're going to go to 1 Chronicles chapter 13 later. So take your Bibles and go with me to Exodus chapter 25. Because I mentioned a few weeks ago that I would be preaching this the following Sunday, and I ended up not preaching it because we had a baptismal service. So tonight is when I'll be preaching that message. But the reason I said we were going to preach the message out of 1 Chronicles 13 is because of what we read in Exodus chapter 25, looking at the making of the Ark of the Lord. So follow with me as I read Exodus 25, verses 10 and following. And they shall make an ark of shittim wood. 2 cubits and a half shall be the length thereof, and 1.5 cubits the breadth thereof, and 1.5 cubits the height thereof. And thou shalt overlay it with pure gold, within and without shalt thou overlay it, and shalt make upon it a crown of gold round about. And thou shalt cast 4 rings of gold for it, and put them in the 4 corners thereof, and 2 rings shall be in the one side of it, and 2 rings in the other side of it. And thou shalt make staves of shittim wood, and overlay them with gold, and thou shalt put the staves into the rings by the sides of the ark, that the ark may be borne with them. The staves shall be in the rings of the ark, they shall not be taken from it. And thou shalt put into the ark the testimony which I shall give thee. Note what he says about the staves, the poles. Obviously, when God had Moses make the ark, he made it so that it could be borne or carried by men. Look back at verse 14, that the ark may be borne with them. Note as well in verse 15, that those staves should not leave the ark. So a constant reminder would be in the ark that it was to be carried by men. Now, 1 Chronicles 13. This is the message for tonight. Following up upon that, we're looking tonight at doing the right thing the wrong way. The right thing the wrong way. Inside this ark was the tables of the covenant, according to what we read there in Exodus chapter 25. Later on, we read, according to Hebrews 9, that also was a gold pot of manna and Aaron's rod that budded. Those were put into this ark. We also read in Numbers chapter 4, verse 15, that the ark was not to be touched. And it was to be carried by poles inserted through rings on its corners, Exodus 25, 14, we just read, by the Levites, Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 8. In Exodus 25, we read, and there I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee. So the ark symbolized God's presence with the children of Israel. It is the ark that preceded them as they marched through the wilderness. According to Numbers 10, verses 35 and 36, when they would go forward, Moses would say, listen, rise up, Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee. And when the ark stopped, he would say, return, O Lord, unto the many thousands of Israel. When Joshua led Israel across the Jordan River, they were preceded by this ark. The river was cut off when the priest's feet touched the water. The ark stayed in the midst of that river when it was dry while the people crossed. It was the ark that preceded the people marching around Jericho when it fell, Joshua chapter 6. In the time of the judges, the people did that which was right in their own eyes, and the ark was captured by the enemy, the Philistines. A child of a priest was born at that time, and he was given the name Ichabod, because the glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken. 1 Samuel 4:22. So the Philistines captured the ark. What happened to the Philistines when they captured the ark? The Philistines were afflicted by the ark. 1 Samuel chapter 5. Dagon, their god, they would get up in the morning and they would see Dagon, their god, fallen and broken, and horrible diseases came upon the people of the Philistines because of the ark. So the Philistines went to their religious leaders, and their religious leaders advised them to take the ark and put it on a cart. Yoked to two cows with young calves. The cows ignored their motherly instincts and returned the ark to Beth Shemesh. 50,070 men in Beth Shemesh were smote because they looked into the ark. So yes, Raiders of the Lost Ark had it right. Then it was taken to Kirjath-Jearim, northwest of Jerusalem, 7.5 miles, and there it stayed in the house of Abinadab for 20 years because men were so fearful of what had taken place. Then David becomes king. And David has this desire to bring back the ark, the symbol of God's presence, to be in the capital of Jerusalem where his name was. That was a good thing. Bring the ark back. But they tried to do it the wrong way. Let's read about that in 1 Chronicles 13. And David consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds and with every leader. And David said unto all the congregation of Israel, if it seem good unto you, and that it be of the Lord our God, let us send abroad unto our brethren everywhere that are left in all the land of Israel, and with them also the priests and Levites which are in their cities and suburbs, that they may gather themselves unto us. And let us bring again the ark of our God to us, for we inquired of it, we inquired not at it in the days of Saul. And all the congregation said that they would do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. So David gathered all Israel together from Shihor of Egypt, even unto the entering of Hemath, to bring the ark of God from Kirjath-Jearim. And David went up in all Israel to Beulah, that is, to Kirjath-Jearim, which belonged to Judah, to bring up thence the ark of God, the Lord, that dwelleth between the cherubims, whose name is called on it. And they carried the ark of God in a new cart out of the house of Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio drave the cart. And David and all Israel played before God with all their might, and with singing, and with harps, and with psalteries, and with timbrels, and with cymbals, and with trumpets. And when they came unto the threshing floor of Chidon, Uzzah put forth his hand to hold the ark, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and he smote him, because he put his hand to the ark, and there he died before God. And David was displeased because the Lord had made a breach upon Uzzah. Therefore that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of God that day, saying, how shall I bring the ark of God home to me? So David brought not the ark home to himself to the city of David, but carried it aside into the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And the ark of God remained with the family of Obed-Edom in his house 3 months, and the Lord blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that he had. What was David's desire? To bring the ark of God home. That's good. And we would ask, as long as it gets there, what difference does it make? What difference does it make how it gets there? Well, maybe it wouldn't matter, folks, except that God had given specific instructions on how it was to be transported. And there was a constant reminder built into that ark. There were four rings, and there were two poles that always told everybody that the ark was to be, it's to be carried. Even if they would forget what God had said, they'd have to look at that ark and say, what are these poles here for? Well, that's for decoration. This is almost like the way ladies decorate their homes. You say, what's that there for? It's for decoration. What good is it? Nothing. It's good to look at. That's way, kind of the way this became. Well, those poles are nice because were the poles gold? Yes. Shit them wood covered with gold. Those poles look really nice. And eventually people began to forget, hey, those poles are there for a reason. God intends for this ark to be borne by people. But there were three attitudes mentioned in this chapter we just read that the men of Israel substituted for what was acceptable to God in order to accomplish a good thing: bringing the Ark of the Covenant back to the capital of Israel. And these are three prevailing attitudes today that Christians like to substitute for serving God. Here are the three things. I'll just give them to you up front. Here's my outline. Number one, sincerity. Men like to substitute sincerity for service to God. As long as he's sincere, you can't question him, you see. The second one is pragmatism. As long as it works. The third one is humanism. Those are three prevailing attitudes you're going to see as we look at 1 Chronicles chapter 13. So, the first attitude is the attitude of sincerity. You read verses 1 through 6. Was David sincere in wanting to bring the ark to Jerusalem? Very sincere. Were the people of Israel sincere in wanting to bring the ark back to Jerusalem? Very sincere. Someone who is sincere, you would say, is genuine. The act of bringing the ark to Jerusalem was a good thing, and the people were sincere about it, but God did not excuse their method as a result. Notice that they were, number one, sincere in their unity. David consulted with the leaders, he consulted with the people of Israel, and in unity they said, yes, let's bring the ark back to Jerusalem. So they were unified in purpose to bring the ark back. They were even unified in method. God was pleased with their purpose, but not with their method. He did not excuse the method because of the purpose. I want to make a point here. So many organizations and ministries have a good statement of purpose. They have a good statement of faith. You can read a statement of faith and you can say, wow, this is a very good organization. Yet they go wrong in how they go about accomplishing that purpose. It's almost like you need to see an organization's statement of practice. I see your statement of faith. I see what you say, but how do you put this into practice? And the statement of faith, what you have here, is very good intentions and sincerity. But now how are you going to carry that about? What are you going to do? Folks, an obedient believer should not unify on the basis of sincerity. Amen. We get fooled by sincerity. Televangelists are good politicians. Televangelists can cry while they preach heresy. And people who are suckers go, oh, but he was so sincere. Or you are so sincerely fooled. Sincerity doesn't cut it. It's unbelievable how Christians excuse music because, but the singer was sincere. He cried when he sang that special and it really touched my heart. Folks, that's what's happening here. There's sincerity, but they're doing it wrong. And that happens all the time. You and I are affected by the emotions. Even you can be affected by my emotions. If I get and I raise my voice, all of a sudden you start listening, those of you who are asleep. So you're affected by the emotions I have. If I start to weep, that would somehow affect you emotionally. Watch out being affected simply by emotions. And sincerity is a big thing that sways people today. Let me put it this way. Supposed sincerity. Because I tell you, some people are great actors and actresses. They can turn on the tears and everybody just melts. And they say, but he was sincere. So, they were sincere in their unity. Secondly, they were sincere in their enthusiasm. Do you see any enthusiasm in verse 8? You see any enthusiasm? David and all Israel played before God with all their might, singing and harps and psalteries, timbrels, cymbals, trumpets. Do you see any enthusiasm here? You know, enthusiasm is lacking, and therefore enthusiasm is much needed. I often say to you folks, sing, come on, sing vibrantly. Sing from the heart. Think about the words you're singing. Sometimes we need enthusiasm. But enthusiasm alone doesn't cut it. You can see their sincerity in their enthusiasm. But it is with enthusiasm that we do need to do the work of God. You know, people can get really enthusiastic about some kind of a sports team. And boy, when that Super Bowl comes around and people have their team, man, they go for it. Or if they're an Auburn supporter, I don't know anybody who supports Auburn. Carol. Or Alabama, Juanita. Did you know we have a church split right here? You got Alabama, Auburn right here. But you know what? You can get so enthusiastic, and I get enthusiastic about college football. I love college football. I got enthusiastic about Northridge football when my boys played. I mean, that was the greatest thing. And the enthusiasm we can display, that we can put on display for everything but for the Lord, should be a rebuke to us. I'm not saying we come into the church screaming like you would at a football game, but there ought to be some enthusiasm. But enthusiasm can also be a distraction. It's contagious. It gives the impression that everybody's involved and supportive, the crowds, the emotional involvement without thinking, and this can become dangerous in religion. You can't deny that God is working. Look at the crowds. Right? A guy once came to me right after we built the church. Knocked on the door. Went to the door. He said, I really want to you know, visit your church because I can see that God is really blessing. I said, how do you see that? He said, well, why, you got such a beautiful building. I said, there's a better building right down the street. I said this to him. I said, there's a better building right down the street. It's the Mormon church. They've got a really nice building. Why don't you go there? I knew the guy, because we had talked while he was a Christian. And I said, if you're going to judge the success of a ministry by the look of the building, you can always find a better building. And so, folks, it is easy for enthusiasm to be a distraction. Remember that the same crowds worked into a frenzy for Christ on Palm Sunday, later that week crucified him. Emotions are fickle. These people were sincere. David was sincere in what they were doing. But when sincerity is accepted, it's not long before, here's my second point, pragmatism comes along. Verse 7. They carried the ark of God in a new cart. Hey, as long as I'm sincere, God ought to accept my sincerity. If it works, do it that way without giving thought to whether it's right or wrong. The end result determines whether the method is right or wrong. The end justifies the means. Hey, it worked for the enemy. It worked for the Philistines. They were in a dilemma. They had this ark, and they needed to get rid of it. How are we going to return it? You know what? The commandments of God are meaningless to the Philistines. They don't care. They just built a new cart and sent it back, and it worked. And as the children of Israel are watching this cart come with two cows, with their calves that they are ignoring, they're saying, wow, it works. We never thought of doing it that way. That must be what they're thinking. So pragmatism worked for the enemy. Number two, it'll work for me. God's people. You see, folks, God's people looked at how the method worked for the Philistines and adopted it for themselves. And believers today have adopted methods of the unconverted. We are today adopting the methods of the Philistines simply because those methods seem to work for the Philistines, without concern for whether the method is right or wrong. Followers of this philosophy ask, but aren't people getting saved? And you know what the answer is? Yes, in many cases, people are getting saved. And they say, well, as long as people are getting saved, you can't knock it. Just look at the results. Well, look at the results here. The ark came to them on a cart, even with two cows going against their calves, bawling after them. And they just kept going. It had to have been God's hand upon those cows. To the Philistines, who didn't care about God's commandments. But now it comes to God's people, and it's time for them to move the ark. And they begin to think, you know what? It worked for them. It'll work for us. Do you see how this philosophy is being adopted by churches? Hey, the music works. The entertainment works. The compromise, it works. This is how we can build our ministry. And we become very pragmatic. If it works, let's adopt it. Let's do it. They even built a new cart. Look again. Verse 7, and they carried the ark of God in a new cart. They took the time to build this new cart. It wasn't the one the Philistines used. You read the passage about that, you'll find out that that cart was chopped up and used for the sacrifice of the two cows. That cart is gone. They built a new cart. Folks, here's the point I'm trying to make. We Christianize the ways of the Philistines and expect God to accept it. What are some of the new carts that so-called believers use to try to bring back the presence of God? Think about that. What are the new carts that we are building? There was an article years ago I read in the newspapers. It was entitled, Religious Retailing Provokes Controversy. Here are some of the things that they mentioned. To take a stand, you put on a Christian bumper sticker or you use Christian products. Gift items and music have overtaken book and Bible sales. For evangelizing, instead of sitting down and talking to people and listening to them, a t-shirt allows you to just say what you want and walk away. That goes along with what I was saying this morning. Discipleship takes time. It takes effort. It takes labor. But in our world today, put a bumper sticker on, hand somebody a tract and get away as fast as possible. They may ask you about it. Instead of taking the time to say, would you hand them the tract? You know, if you would read this, I would really like to talk about what you read in here sometime. Could we make an appointment where I could talk to you about what you read here? It goes on to say, trying to create a parallel universe in a secular world, instead of Disneyland, they have Christian theme parks. Instead of Madonna, they have Amy Grant. This is in the newspaper. Philistine music with Christian words is what I added to that. This article said, you name the secular product and we probably have the Bible equivalent. Scones, mud flaps, wallpaper, candy bars, mouse pads. And then they concluded this way, the product has become a sermon. The words of the preacher have been replaced by objects. It's in a secular newspaper. You see, once you adopt sincerity and say that sincerity is all that matters, pretty soon you adopt pragmatism. If it works, that's all that matters. And then, you know what the next step is? What was the third one I mentioned? Humanism. Then you come up to humanism, not necessarily the way you understand humanism as in the educational system, but a humanism that I want to see as defined by the dictionary. A system of thought that centers on human beings and their values, capacities, and worth, concerned with the interests, needs, and welfare of human beings. So I am using the word humanism in this way. Worship is all about what makes me feel good. Worship, according to the dictionary definition, is concerned with my interests, my needs, and my welfare. That's humanism. 2 points under this. It was evidenced by Uzzah, verses 9 and 10. He's the one who had the audacity to touch that which is holy. Numbers chapter 4, verse 15 says, they shall not touch any holy thing lest they die. And we just read in Exodus chapter 25 that poles were plainly inserted into those rings, never to be removed. Can you think about this? Can you imagine what was on top of that new cart that these people built? On top of this cart was the Ark of the Covenant with the poles inserted. They were defiant to God, saying, yeah, we see the poles, but our cart is a better idea. We can do things our way because this is not about you. It is too much to carry the ark. It's easier if we put it on a cart. Humanism. How could they ever get to this point where a man thinks he has the right to do directly contrary to what God had commanded and get by with it? I'll tell you how they got to this point. Sincerity, pragmatism, and now they're here at humanism. And today, no longer are there any standards for entering the ministry. We don't focus on what God requires, but the felt needs of humans. Therefore, you have adulterers in the ministry, women in the ministry, homosexuals in the ministry, because it doesn't matter what God thinks. It's what makes us feel good, what makes us feel fulfilled. Did you know that the standards for the priests were even higher than for the rest of the people? I was talking to somebody this morning about this. The standards that the priests had. Did you know that if you were a dwarf, you couldn't be a priest? That if your nose was broken, you could not be a priest? And there's other things there. It's in Leviticus chapter 21, verses 18 to 20. There were certain things that if something was true of you physically, you were not able to be in the priesthood. Now the dwarf could say, but I can't help it. God understands that. And you might say, but you know, some of the things that have happened in my life, I mean, this happened to me, and try as I couldn't stave it off, and I regret that it happened, but it did. Well, just like the dwarf couldn't help the fact that he was a dwarf, you may have been able to help what happened to you, but still, God has standards. You couldn't have a blemish, couldn't be blind, couldn't be lame, couldn't have a broken nose, could not have ever broken his hand or foot, couldn't be a dwarf. These men were to offer offerings to God, and they had to be holy. Well, that would fly in the face of today's, what do they call it? American Disabilities Act. But it doesn't matter. Good intentions Uzzah had, but he had an unsanctified mind and an unsanctified heart. Folks, God doesn't excuse what we do simply because we had good intentions. Well, I meant good. It's no excuse. So humanism as evidenced by Uzzah. Secondly, humanism was evidenced by David himself. When God struck Uzzah and killed him, what was David's response? Let's read again verses 11 and 12. And David was displeased because God had struck Uzzah. He was concerned for man. He wasn't concerned about God's holiness. And what's the whole issue here? It's the holiness of God. We have begun to adjust our Christianity so we don't offend men instead of being concerned about the holiness of God. Christians are becoming more and more concerned about hurting people rather than hurting God's work. Paul once said, "If I yet pleased men, I should not be the servant of Christ." I don't try to offend men, but listen, when you do God's work, people will be offended. Notice that each stage progresses by excusing the previous stage. You don't just jump into humanism. You don't just jump. We haven't just jumped into the type of worship that's in our churches today. We just didn't get there overnight. There were stages that led up to that. You arrive there in stages. It starts with sincerity. So whatever it is that accomplishes whatever I'm sincere about is justified in our minds. Then, in order to ensure that what I have instituted indeed does work, I must step in to help. Had they transported as God had commanded, a man would not have had to step in and help by catching the ark so it wouldn't fall. Later, David and all Israel do the right thing in the right way. Go to chapter 15. Notice verse 2. Then David said, "None ought to carry the ark of God but the Levites, for them hath the Lord chosen to carry the ark of God and to minister unto him forever. You see, we need to get back to the word, and that's what David did to get himself back on the right path. It's like, you know, folks, I was reading in Numbers chapter 4 and I was reading in Exodus chapter 25. You know what I forgot? That we all forgot that, you know what? The ark is not supposed to be on a cart. It's supposed to be carried. And it's supposed to be carried by the men that God has designated so. Chapter 15, verse 15. And the children of the Levites bear the ark of God upon their shoulders with the staves thereon, as Moses commanded according to the word of the Lord. Verse 28. Thus all Israel brought up the ark of the covenant of the Lord with shouting and with sound of the cornet and with trumpets and with cymbals, making a noise with psalteries and harps. Chapter 16, verse 1. So they brought the ark of God and set it in the midst of the tent that David had pitched for it, and they offered burnt sacrifices and peace offerings before God. Tremendous singing takes place, verses 4 through 6 of chapter 16. Great thanksgiving is given, chapter 16, verses 7, all the way to verse 36, and the entire Psalm 105. There was a continual ministry as a result. Look at chapter 16 and verse 37. So he left there before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, Asaph and his brethren, to minister before the ark continually as every day's work required. Here's the point. Man's method for accomplishing God's work may seem to get much done, but in the end, more damage is done than good. God's work accomplished God's way makes for a continuing ministry. Folks, may you never as an individual, and may we never as a church come to the place where we simply replace what God wants done because, well, we're sincere. And, well, this works. And we need to be careful that we don't offend anybody. God's work, accomplished God's way, makes for a continuing ministry. Now, I know people have been saved through the ministry of men who have compromised. And they say, well, I got saved through that. I understand that. But what we have never taken into account is the damage, the permanent damage that has been done. I believe our country is in the shape it is in today because of compromise. The compromise of the church. I'm talking about good fundamental Bible preaching churches. They've compromised. And our country is in the condition it is today because of that compromise. Did any good take place through some of the things they did? Yeah. Some of the things that we might look at and say, well, that was good. But in the end, that good has been countered by all the bad, by all the damage that's been done, by the compromise. May we never give in to that. It's easy to, because you may have a friend who, you know, wow, I want to support him. Yeah, but you know what? You can't. Because of what he or she is involved in. We've got to be careful.